Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Sarah Rich, co-founder of the Foodprint Project. Last night, I was reading through the new edition of a great book called Edible Estates by Fritz Haig, and there's an essay in it by one of the country's leading urban farmers, Will Allen, who runs Growing Power in Milwaukee. And in the essay, Allen says, small farming and even home gardening involves inspiration followed by perspiration, all too often ending in exasperation. And I think most people in the room who have tried growing their own food can probably relate to this statement, but also most of us advocate strongly for the burgeoning urban farming movement. So tonight we're going to hear from some people who've managed not to let exasperation get in the way of their crusade to spread urban farming throughout the Bay Area and beyond. We have four great panelists, all of whom are literally breaking new ground in local urban food and farming. To my left is Jason Mark, the editor-in-chief of the magazine Earth Island Journal and co-manager of Alamany Farm. Novella Carpenter is the acclaimed author of Farm City and the founder of Ghost Town Farm in Oakland. Christopher Burley is the founder and co-director of the newly launched Hayes Valley Farm, an education and research project focused on urban agriculture. And David Gavrich, sometimes called the Goat Guy, is the founder of City Grazing, SF's herd of weed-eating goats. So, let's get to the discussion, and at the end, we will allow some time for questions. All right. So I wanted to start with something that I believe Jason brought up in some of our preliminary conversations about this evening, which is the idea that a few decades back, people who were sort of agriculturally minded and interested in farming would probably have retreated from the city, and you know, the back to the land movement took people sort of to drop out of urban culture and go places where they could cultivate the land and farm. But today, a lot of people are sort of taking their agricultural instincts and putting beehives on fire escapes and growing vegetables on their rooftops. So I want to ask you guys first sort of how the urban farming movement of today reflects people's changing attitudes about rural and urban living. Jason, you want to start since you brought that up?
Yeah, sure. I just think it's really interesting also, you know, if you read Novella's book, right? Novella's parents, your parents were homesteaders, right?
Hippies,
and hippies, back to the land hippies. And that was sort of the dominant thought, right? A generation ago was like, well, if we want to have a more sustainable society, we're going to have to drop out of urban living and the industrial economy and get closer to our own food source. And I think a lot of people now, or at least us four, and maybe hopefully a lot of other people in the audience, are sort of thinking, well, maybe there's a different way and that we can actually stay in the cities and still grow a lot of food and create the urban places where now 50% of humanity lives as a real model for sustainability. And so, right, because like not everybody's going to go to Sonoma and read poems in the fog. You know, that sounds really fun, and we could all do that and grow our own food, but there's probably not enough room for us all in Sonoma. And so let's stay here in San Francisco or in Oakland or wherever it is, Silicon Valley, and grow our food there. So I think that's what's happening is people trying to balance those tensions between sustainability and urban living and finding that it's not a contradiction.
Yeah, I can agree with that. And I also think that part of it is kind of the aesthetic of that day was sort of this idea that wilderness was this pristine, beautiful thing that was other, and that you could go there and be there. Whereas we're kind of just like, man, everything's effed, right? You know, like everything. And so if we can kind of like dig around and find like one little part that's not messed up, then we can sort of feel like, okay, you know, we can make change, positive change. I also think a lot of it is the food movement. You know, people are like really into eating good food, and that we are a reaction to that, where we're like, well, we want to eat really good food too, but we are poor and we can't afford it. And so then we're like, wait a minute, I know how to grow stuff. And so then we're having this sort of, you know, event happen.
I think what's amazing is when you ask a friend of yours, per se, I have a few programmer friends, and they're like, oh man, I love that you're out on the farm. I love that you're toiling in the soil. I love that you're really just getting in there and really enjoying all that food. And then we look at them and we're like, man, I really love your paycheck. And I really love the fact that you don't have to come to dinner meetings with your fingernails dirty, and that, you know, you're not continually smelling like fish oil emulsion. And so I think there's a lot of us who are trying to find that balance. Farm City talks a lot about that balance that you're trying to achieve. Probably the same thing for Jason at Alamany and myself at Hayes Valley Farm. And we're trying to bring the rural environment into the urban environment, but also trying to take a piece of the urban environment back into the rural environment. Some may say it's the middle path, but I say it's just kind of like we're all just trying to find that niche that we fit in. And we've just happened to find it a little bit sometimes at the Ghost Town Farm, sometimes at Hayes Valley Farm. And I think everyone who plants a seed is kind of sowing a bit of future sustainability. And when they do that, they're recognizing that maybe we have come a little bit far from the rural environment. Maybe we need to go back to it. And so finding that balance is where we're at.
Well, by evidence of not just us, but a packed room listening to urban farming on a school night, we put an ad in when we first got our goats. I put an ad in Craigslist for goat herder, San Francisco. The next day, I had 200 applications for goat herder San Francisco, and half of them had goat experience. So in my mind, I think what's happening is I think you have a lot of people coming into the urban area from maybe a country background, or some that didn't have a country background, but who are yearning to get out from behind their desks. And whether it's on a full-time basis or whether it's on a part-time basis, get some contact with nature in some way, tangible way, and I think that's what's happening here.
So a lot of people in the Bay Area obviously kind of get it with the urban farming, and we have a lot of it going on, and people have seen a lot of it. Novella, I wanted to ask you, because I know you've been traveling around a lot with your book, sort of what people make of urban farming in general, and, you know, specifically, I think, you know, what you're doing is a particular way of immersing yourself in the urban homesteading and farming lifestyle. So what have you found that people make of you in other places?
Oh, dude, everywhere I go, I find myself. They usually look different, or they're men or something like that, but when I go to any city, any major city, I'm like, take me to your urban farmer, and they will. So it's not just this area. It's exploding everywhere. It's even happening in, you know, in New York. I went to, I was just there recently, actually, and there's some guys that are starting a urban farm on this rooftop in Queens. It's an acre on a rooftop. So they're totally awesome. And, you know, everyone's doing what they can. You know, it's sort of like, well, this is our, there's no way they're going to do what I do, which is find vacant lots. There just aren't vacant lots. But then they're like sort of thinking about rethinking the rooftop. And, you know, a lot of the buildings there are built to be bomb-proof so they can hold that weight. And one of the guys is an engineer, so he's done the sort of analysis to make sure it's not going to collapse the building, which is good. And then they are totally growing a lot of food there. And for instance, last summer, you know, everyone got the tomato blight and what, you know, were devastated by it, but they did not because they're on a rooftop. So it's like you can have this advantage sometimes. So that's been really cool. And I've learned so many things. And, you know, I was in, you know, Providence, Rhode Island, and met this great guy, Rich Peterson, who has an urban farm there. And, you know, I learned things from him. You know, he's like, hey, I have this harvest festival every year. And, you know, all these kids from the neighborhood come down, and they don't think, you know, like when I think of a harvest fest, I think like cheesy, like, you know, overalls and like listening to like hoedown music or something.
Pony rides.
Yeah, pony rides. He's like full on DJs in the street, and it's like a party. And then the kids are all like, when's the next harvest festival? Because they don't even know what a, you know, corny harvest festival is. So that kind of stuff is really exciting for me.
I think this has been really normalized because like when Will Allen got the MacArthur Genius Award, the New York Times story and the AP story and the Reuters story just said urban farmer Will Allen, and it wasn't in quotes. Like I would bet to guess that 10, 15 years ago it would have been like urban farmer Will Allen, and yet there's enough of this around, whether it's here in the Bay Area or in the places you've been, or like Birmingham, Alabama has a 10-acre tractor farm, Jones Valley urban farm, in like the center of Birmingham, right? I mean, so this is really going beyond some of the usual. It's not just Cambridge and San Francisco, right? I mean, it's happening in a lot of unusual and unlikely places. Detroit, which is probably, you know, going to be the epicenter for urban farming, because they have so much space, and it's basically a ghost city. And so they're able to take all that land and repurpose it.
David, you might be able to speak to this a little bit, and maybe others too. Obviously, entrepreneurship is another thing that's hot in the Bay Area, and often that relates to tech and the internet. But I think also a lot of people are starting to sort of direct their entrepreneurial instincts towards farming endeavors. My Farm is a good example, and City Grazing, of course, and others. What are your thoughts about becoming a farm entrepreneur in the city?
Well, I can tell you what the personal experience was and how I got into it, and it was opportunistic. It was entrepreneurial in some ways. My other job, my day job, is my company runs a railroad for the Port of San Francisco and the City of San Francisco. And traditionally, the railroads, I'm not sure you know how they maintain their vegetation, but they, around the tracks, because it's a federal requirement to keep the vegetation down because there's tripping hazards and walking hazards for the workers walking along the rail cars. But when I first got into the railroad business, I found out that they were spraying some incredibly heavy-duty herbicides along the right-of-way of railroads. And did not want to do that in San Francisco, so I looked for an alternative. So I kind of backed into the goat business, found that there were 10 goats in Petaluma that were about to be slaughtered, and basically said to this gal, Nancy Barless of Barless Boer Goats, I said, if I pay you what you would be getting to have them slaughtered, would you sell them to me? And she sold them to me. And that 10 begat 20, and 20 begat 40, and that's how goats do it. And so I started out of necessity. I wanted to get away from herbicides, and then I started getting phone calls. People saw the goats and said, do you rent them out? Would you rent them out? And so we got a trailer, and we started taking them to other places. And so it evolved as a business, but it started kind of as a personal way of avoiding herbicides. And when you look at the economics of it, and you truly understand externalities, and that's impact on the environment. And if our society would cost those externalities and impacts on the environment, then it makes a tremendous amount of sense. And it makes economic sense as well as environmental sense. We haven't gotten to the point of costing out some of those pollution impacts, but we're getting there. I mean, you know, with thinking about carbon banking and the like, we're getting there. But it can actually be a business that does well while you're still doing good. So it really does pay.
Mm-hmm. And another factor, I think, in what you've done in your area and all four of you have done is sort of the neighborhood revitalization and community building aspect of urban farming. So anyone who wants to pick up on that, I mean, can you talk a little bit about how you've seen sort of community come together around that or neighborhood improvement?
Chris, you've got an incredible community there in Hayes Valley.
Yeah, I mean, I went to grad school and essentially studied community and coalition building as one part of the grad work. And there's all these manuals and how-tos, you know, how to build a community. And I was confused but also really enlightened by a lot of stuff. And then I came to Hayes Valley Farm, and the goal is just to get people to the site. However you do it, whether you pull them in from outside the fence or you send them an email or whatever. And we're seeing, I don't know, 50 people on a Thursday show up for 4 hours to toil. Shovel horse manure, and about 100 people on Sundays, which is kind of incredible. And thus far, we've been around for, I think, I don't know, 3-4 months. We've had about 3,500 hours of volunteer time. And so I'm looking less at these textbooks that I studied once and looking more at just using urban agriculture as a strategy to build community and to increase community resiliency, because people want to get involved, they want to connect with their neighbors, they get a benefit that they enjoy 3 times a day out of it. There's just a lot of intangibles around urban agriculture that I don't think some of us originally thought about. And when we're in it and we're connecting with these people, you're having neighbors come over from the community. It's really, really amazing. And I highly suggest all of you to start your own little urban farm in your backyard, invite some neighbors over, have a potluck. It's pretty awesome.
I think the community is one of the big things that really distinguishes, right, the back to the land homesteading from the urban farming. It's like there's so many people who are turning out every weekend. We've had the same experience at Alamany Farm as at Hayes Valley Farm. You know, routinely 20, 30 people every weekend. We have a Monday afternoon work day, routinely 15, 20 people. So we've got, you know, 50 people coming in the gate every week, just eager to work. And in the course of that, we really built, I think, a pretty incredible community there of volunteers. The farm is basically all volunteer run, and we grow, you know, several tons of food a year on volunteer labor. And people keep coming back, partially, I think, because of the spirit of, like, just neighborliness, you know, sort of small-end neighborliness that they get there. And a lot of us now are really close friends. I mean, there's a real sort of, like, core group of friends who perhaps would not have met otherwise had it not been for our shared curiosity and passion in sustainability and in local food systems. And so now there's this whole group of folks that really is a pretty vibrant community.
And mine is a little different because it was an accident that I, you know, built community or whatever you want to call it. And part of it is just that because mine is more of like a personal thing. So when I first started gardening, you know, I was just sort of like, you know, plant my vegetables. And then I started noticing, if you've read the book, you know, people are like picking my vegetables. That isn't me, right? And then I started to, at first it was kind of like one of those things where I was like, hey, wait a minute. And then I realized in my neighborhood, people are actually really hungry, hungry enough to want to come in and pick carrots. And so then I sort of felt not called to action, you know, like how can I be hoarding all this food? If I know how to grow food and my neighbors are hungry, then how could I not grow food for everyone, right? And what's been great is that it's not like I'm some kind of like person that comes in and is like a do-gooder. It's like I started growing food. Some people wanted to pick it, and it's become this whole community of people. You know, like I'll run into Al on the street, and I'll be like, Al, what's up? What do you want? He's like, where are the greens? I'm like, yeah, all right, I need to plant the mustards. And then I plant him a row of mustards, and then I see him the next day, and he's like, hey, I found you a wagon, you know? And so he brings me a wagon. And so it's like this whole thing. Everybody gives what they can. So it's not like I'm like, here's some charity. You know, I feel really sorry for you. It's kind of like, wow, this person has this to offer. You know, my liquor store owner, Moses, who lives, you know, just down the street, he, when I first got goats, I have some goats too now, and he was, I came into his, you know, liquor store, I was talking to him, and, you know, I'm like, yeah, I have goats now, and he's like, I was a goat farmer in Yemen before I came here. And then I'm like, yeah, you're going to help me when I have to kill a goat, you know, or whatever. And so it's that kind of thing where a garden, a farm becomes a conversation, and it becomes this whole thing that everybody can jump into. Everyone has something to offer. You know, maybe it's, you know, they just want to weed or whatever, but everybody has a story to tell and is part of that, you know, fabric.
So around the city, I would imagine that you guys have sometimes encountered some bureaucratic hurdles with, you know, utilizing land for this purpose. So I wonder, you know, what kind of challenges have you encountered? Is San Francisco really open to this type of thing, and Oakland as well? You know, do you ever have to fight against it? Have you found that they're making changes?
Why don't I start on that one, because I have 80 goats in the city. So surprisingly little, if any, bureaucratic. But we planned ahead. We basically spoke to the Port Commission when we had this idea, and we said, we want to get away from herbicides. And they said, go for it. And so we put a clause in our lease that basically is the goat clause. And it literally says that all of our landscape management will be done using goats or other natural means. And they were all for it. So, I think if you plan ahead, I think if you explain yourself in this city particularly, I think it'll be very, very well received.
I can jump in because I do know of a story. I'm in Oakland. It's total anarchy. I can do whatever the hell I want. But but I do have friends in San Francisco who are having major problems right now. And part of it is that Little City Garden, which is this amazing, they grow microgreens and herbs for restaurants. They are having problems with it's different when you have a business right next to residential places, and so they're encountering major problems, and they've had a person come out and issue them a citation for running a business next to residential. And so it isn't like I wish it could be the perfect thing, but because it is different if you're like trying to grow greens and sell them to restaurants, and then one neighbor doesn't like you, and so they report you. So that's a problem, and that's something to talk to the mayor about, or write a letter or call them and try to get that changed. Do you know about that? Did you hear about that?
I guess I would characterize. So at Alameda Farm, we're on Recreation and Park Department property. We've received funding from the Department of the Environment and some other city agencies. And I think there's Mayor Newsom's proposal on food security here in the city is really far reaching and is really progressive. And I think in some ways actually truly visionary, right? So go find it and download it and read it. On paper, it's really impressive. Unfortunately, city bureaucracy is a big, huge, unwieldy thing, and there's a lot of people in city government who probably haven't read it. And so, we continue to have some challenges and hurdles with just sort of getting city staff to connect with the policies at the grass tops. I think city staff, in some ways, kind of, I think urban farming is still a strange animal, right? And they don't really know what to make of it, and they don't really know how to classify it, and they don't understand how the taxonomy of urban farming, I guess, works. And so, yes, call the mayor's office and say we love urban farming because I think there's a lot of really great political energy for urban farming in this town, but sometimes actually getting the spade to hit the ground, if I can twist a metaphor, is a little challenging. I don't know, Chris, what's your experience?
Well, I was thinking like with my farm, we didn't run into too many challenges in people's backyards, but we were mostly selling vegetables to the people who own the backyard farms. So there wasn't kind of this like leap of food safety, food security, not to mention even kind of the commerce aspect of taxing. However, with Little City Gardens, from my understanding, they're really trying to get a residential area to be approved to be a market garden area, which is something that I think we all should be advocating for, because when you look at the available landmass in San Francisco, roughly 61% of our arable landmass is in people's backyards. And so, and that's also the area where it's most capable or most able to actually take action, because there's one or two, maybe three decision makers. So when you ask Rec and Park, per se, to donate 3 acres of McLaren Park to grow a food forest, they're going to look at you with crossed eyes. But when you ask a few homeowners to dedicate their backyard to growing food, you're probably going to get a few heads that are nodding forward, maybe one nodding side to side. And so with regards to the city, we've had a lot of good luck with Hayes Valley Farm because the city came to us, wanted to activate the lot. It was old, decrepit. Vagrants were constantly camping there. In fact, we heard stories that the vagrants were there so much that they had little rock pathways leading up to the tents, kind of temporary but permanent. And the city came to us and really just wanted us to activate the space. So it was a super easy, only about 6 months of a process to get that lot. But I've heard a lot of challenges at Alemany with regards to selling and things of that nature in other urban areas of the city. It's just really challenging. So I would advocate for the backyards, and I would advocate for the bottom-up approach as opposed to relying on city government, because as Jason said, mayor, awesome initiative. People are still eating donuts on their breaks, though.
I ran an event in New York about food and urbanism, and we had a guy from the New School who's an urban planning professor, who told us that in New York there are 52,000 acres of backyard space, and if all 52,000 acres were used to grow vegetables, you could feed 700,000 people fresh fruits and vegetables. I don't know what the equivalent is in San Francisco and Bay Area broadly, but I'm sure it's probably at least that much, considering that we have more yard space in the broader Bay Area. So since food security sort of, comes up, I don't know, Novella, you probably have the most direct experience in terms of being really in close proximity to people who are hungry. But, I mean, is that true at Alamany Farm? Do you find that right around you there's sort of a food security issue?
Yeah, so Alamany Farm, we're located right next to a 165-unit public housing complex. And in the past at the farm, we've run youth programs, after-school youth programs there at the farm for teens in the Alamany public housing development. Currently, what we're doing in terms of addressing food security, and the interesting thing about food security or food insecurity, right, is that in this country, yes, I mean, obviously there's a lot. There's what, 1 in 8 Americans get food assistance. There's a real gap there, but there's also, of course, the obesity and type 2 diabetes epidemic. And so people, in a sense, they're actually getting the calories they need to eat, but there's a real public health crisis, right, in terms of not access to fresh fruits and vegetables. We try to respond to that by doing a free 20-family CSA. For 2 years, we did a farmer's market in the Bayview neighborhood on 3rd and Oakdale, where we sold food at subsidized prices with a grant from the Department of the Environment. Now, basically, because we can't sell food, so sort of strange, we had one city department saying sell food and other city departments saying don't sell any food. We now are giving the food away for free. And there are some real challenges with that. I mean, Novella sort of brought it up. A charity model is not necessarily sustainable in the long run. And so we're still really trying to figure out how do we address the problems of food insecurity in the low-income neighborhoods that we're adjacent to. And it's a long road to hoe. It's really challenging to really figure out how exactly we can make it work.
Another thing last night, when I was reading this Will Allen essay that I keep referring to, he was talking a bit about how, there are all these independent projects that are helping people in very close proximity, but if you really want food security, you have to have a local food system. The quote that I pulled out says, even if you have some space, time, and energy to devote to growing your own food, you will never know food security unless you become part of a local food system. Do you see some of these projects starting to network with each other to sort of form a citywide food system? Are the food systems smaller than that?
Yeah, actually, we actually just started. One of the members in the crowd, Antonio, has started bringing a lot of the people in the urban agriculture movement together to form essentially an urban agriculture alliance. And we have a visioning retreat coming up, but I bet that we're going to be aiming towards a much larger San Francisco, if not Bay Area, secure regenerative food production system, including, robust kitchen backyard food production programs and food forests as opposed to wild native plant forests or things of that nature, all contributing together from like a more whole systems perspective. And I think that is necessary. We can all do a little bit on our balcony or our backyard, but a concerted effort with government backing over time is really going to lead towards something where the Bay Area can eventually feed itself.
Yeah, I'm working on a project in San Lorenzo, which everyone's like, "Where's that?" It's just south of Oakland, and it's so funny because I just met with some guys that are have money funding for through the sheriff's department in San Lorenzo. So it's kind of like this strange bedfellows kind of situation. But they're doing job training, and so it's part of the Green Jobs Program. And so we're like, "Dude, we need someone to weed the farm. It's an acre. It's a historic farm." And so there are all these things. As everyone has similar ideas, it's all starting to coalesce, and that's awesome. There's going to be a group. I can't wait. Cool. Hope I'm invited.
So as urban farming does take off, I mean, you do read some articles where people actually have plans to do really, really large-scale urban farms, like in Detroit. There's this guy who wants to some of you have probably read about it, but a guy who wants to invest many millions of dollars to basically, you know, raise large swaths of Detroit and plant huge amounts of farmland, almost to the point of sort of going beyond what I think a lot of us picture as urban farming now because it's so small scale, and growing crops for biofuels and things like that. Do you have an opinion of when urban farming hits that level? You know, what happens? Is it still a good thing? Controversial?
Be really careful when we start expanding to the kind of levels that some of the environmental entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs are looking at, specifically the group in Detroit. And there's a lot of talk about sustainable agriculture, sustainable farming. And I love the way that Toby Hemingway spells it out. He basically says, we're all aiming towards sustainable agriculture, but what really is sustainable? Like, if you were to ask someone, like, how's your relationship with your partner or your wife? And they say, oh, it's sustainable. You know, like, is that really what we want to go for? And, you know, so I'm kind of thinking, like, we need to move a little bit beyond that. We need to move towards something that's more regenerative. And I think I read a fact or heard it in a movie, 83 billion tons of soil lost every year. And I get a little concerned then when we start kind of going these back to the land movement, specifically in Detroit, because we have to be a little bit careful not to regress back into this period where we are kind of just mining the soil to meet our needs, and we have to look at future generations and their livelihood and form a style of agriculture, whether it's sustainable agriculture or beyond agriculture. Some people are leaning more towards permaculture to actually take care of all the needs that we have, as well as create more abundance, build more soil, increase biodiversity for future generations. I don't know the specifics about the Detroit farm, but from what I read on their website, it looks a little challenging. And coming from Michigan, I get a little concerned too, because I've seen the kind of devastation that farmers are under, family members of mine are under, as a result of the lack of opportunity in Michigan. And I all power to them, but I'd love to really check out their business plans, really look at how sustainable it is, and maybe kind of push them towards a regenerative form of agriculture.
I think, you know, Detroit's an anomaly, right? In some ways, I mean, I'm actually kind of ambivalent on, because I don't live in Detroit, so I don't want to take a real firm stance on what's happening there, because it's, you know, for the communities in Detroit to really figure out. But as Chris said earlier, in most of the country, even if it's a sprawl mecca, like, let's say, Phoenix, or, I don't know, even Las Vegas or something, most of the land that's going to be arable is still going to remain in people's front yards and backyards. You know, this is like the great Heather Flores book, Food Not Lawns, right? It's like, what do we need to be doing to actually digging up not just our backyards, but our front yards and our side yards, and thinking about how can we create little sort of mini gardens in our own spaces that are ornamentally really beautiful and vibrant, and then still also provide a modicum. And I don't think it's like, you know, even spending, I spend three afternoons out at Alamany every week, and it's a pretty nice sized garden, right? It's like a 2-acre garden, but that doesn't, you know, supply all of my organic fruits and vegetables. Like, I still go to the farmer's market, right? So these little backyards, it's not like you're going to be self-sufficient from your little backyard, but what you're going to do is you're going to get just a little bit more in tune with the physical systems on which we depend, right? So like everybody, if you just put in a backyard tomato plant, you become by necessity a meteorologist and a hydrologist and a botanist. Often you've got to become so much more aware of all of these natural systems. So I actually think the biggest leap for people in becoming something of their own food producer is less about food security narrowly than it is ecological sustainability or ecological restoration more broadly, because it makes everybody like a small e ecologist. All of a sudden you start to really get how natural systems fit together, even if you're just growing some peas on the side of the house and they get eaten. And then you're like, well, what ate them? And then you go online and you go to the UC Davis site and you like start looking up bugs, right? You're going to learn something about how the natural world works. So, you know, I think the big tractor farms, it's less about that than it is about encouraging the micro backyard victory gardens. San Francisco residents, definitely check out Garden for the Environment's Victory Garden Project. Try to get a backyard garden installed in your own home. Or if you live in Oakland, check out City Slicker Farms. These, I think, are the really exciting places.
You know, from our perspective and from a business perspective, actually small is better for us, because we're competing against the goat herds that have thousands of goats that have to come in from a long, long distance and have some pretty significant economic and environmental impacts coming in and bringing these goats in to the urban area. We have 80 goats. We can actually do backyard grazing for people, and we are starting to do that. And we're getting a lot of calls for people to drop off 3 or 4 goats to clean the weeds in their backyard. And we drop them off for a week, and we pick them up a week later, and they don't let them go because they've fallen in love with our goats. But the big companies can't do that. You know, the big companies have to intensively, you know, feed and intensively raise their herds, whereas we've got a very sustainable small herd that can do these niche little markets. And so I think, to some extent, the vegetable gardens are in that way, too. They're closer to the market. The delivery is easier. It's less impacting on the environment, and you're closer to the customer. And so it allows you to have an agility by being small that you don't have on those intense large bases.
I want to talk a little bit about education and how, you know, we've got Edible Schoolyard, and I think a lot of, you know, from the White House onward, a lot of people are thinking about incorporating growing food into school curricula. I know at least some of you are using your facilities for education. Maybe you could start, Chris, and tell us about what you guys are doing at Hayes Valley.
A good friend of mine, David, just recently told me before coming here, like, we can't change what we don't know. And so we don't look at Hayes Valley Farm as kind of this large food production site. We look at the major yield is education and behavioral change because, as Jason was kind of cluing into, what we all need to become is a little bit more aware of our impact on the world. And food, in my opinion, is kind of the gateway drug to a more sustainable, self-sufficient lifestyle. And when you bring people onto the site, when you show them the magic, when you give them a little opportunity to pay $10 or whatever they can afford to actually come and get a little bit of a course, they start keying into how cool it can be. And then you get these people who have bees in the balcony and or bees on the roof, or they have a goat in the backyard or 80 goats near their railroad tracks. And little by little, we're going to, I think, not necessarily regress as a society, but connect back more, much more closely to what is it going to take for us to thrive as a community. What is it going to take for us to really achieve, quote-unquote, sustainability, but at a personal level, but achieving kind of collective health? And I think that starts with education.
I work at this place called Biofuel Oasis, and we have an urban farming store, and that's what we do all day long is educate people. You know, people come in to buy bee supplies, and then we're just like, this is what you want to do, or here's what you want to buy, and we teach classes and stuff, and it's awesome to see people so excited about this. You know, I just taught a goat class this weekend, and people are just like, I brought the goats, and they're like, oh my God, you know, it was like that. And, you know, my only worry is that I just want to make sure that we just, like, you know, rein it in a little bit. It's exciting, but, like, this is, like, make sure you want to get some goats, and, you know, just, like, I'm just a little bit, because I'm the kind of person that's like, 2 pigs, let's do it, and then, later, I'm like, why did I do that? And so, you know, just not to curb the enthusiasm, but just, I worry a little bit about trends and stuff, you know, like my parents back to land hippies, and then everyone's like, well, screw that, that didn't work. And so to build it, we really have to educate in this way that's, you know, sustainable. Like, you know, we have to make sure that everyone is doing things that are sane and respectful for their neighbors and those kinds of things. So, smart education. And also, I mean, I think that the kids are going to be the huge thing. And I see this all the time. Like, I think that 12-year-olds are better cooks than I am. Has anyone else noticed that? That they are on the food tip majorly. And so they are really into farming and growing food now, too. So I see a lot of hope out there for kids and farming.
I mean, I want to echo what Novella said. We host a lot of field trips out at the farm, and it's the ecological awareness of the 10-year-olds is really higher than I think probably most middle-aged folks. I give, I don't know, probably like at least 2 or so field trips a month out at the farm or something like that. I give basically the exact same 45-minute tour to fifth graders as I do to the corporate counsel's office from Google, right? Because their overall ecological awareness is pretty much at the same level, right? In terms of, like, this is compost. This is, like, how you put the seed in the ground. Like, this is how it works. And so even if people just come out for an afternoon at Alamany Farm, they're getting a real crash course education. So I agree with Chris. The main harvest is not produce by the pound. It's really like the experiences that people are taking away from coming out and spending an afternoon in the garden.
So we're going to get to questions from the audience, and we need people to speak into the microphone. So if you have a question, if you can stand up, and I think the microphone is coming down the aisle. Do we have any questions?
So thank you very much for everything that you've said. Hi there. One thing that I've also noticed, I've been going to a lot of events like this, talking about urban farming, and it's very exciting to see how much energy there is. But I always feel like I am looking at a row full of white people. And, you know, like, what do you, and I know you guys are all really aware of that. And, you know, what do you think, what's that happening, and how come, because there's obviously a lot of people of color doing this kind of work, how come they're not up where you guys are at? Just curious what people had to say about that.
I mean, I can address that. My farm partner at the LaBrie farm in San Lorenzo is African-American. We were actually just talking about this last night. We're like, well, what happens is with white culture is you're in denial that there's white culture, right? And so is urban farming like for white people? I don't think so. As I've traveled around, I've met lots of people of color that are doing urban farming. I can't speak to why all of us are white here on this panel, but it is true. And it's something to, maybe it's, we have more time to do something, or we have privilege, and so we can, like, you know, squander our money on pigs or something. I don't know. But there is something there. There is something there. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I don't know that this panel is entirely representative of the urban farming movement. I mean, I think if you just, again, right next to where Novella is, I mean, you've got People's Grocery, which is a people of color-led organization that's working in people of color communities to boost, you know, food security and to, you know, grow green jobs. And then again, you know, Will Allen in Milwaukee, or and his daughter Erica Allen in Chicago. I think in general, in some encouraging ways, I think the urban farm movement is in general more ethnically diverse than the broader green or environmental movement. Now, that's not saying a whole lot. I mean, that's setting the bar pretty low. But it's true, and it's really encouraging. And I think that's because of what Chris said, that food is the gateway drug, that everybody's culture connects to food. So at Alamany Farm, we maybe have not had entirely the involvement that we would hope for from the farm's closest neighbors. But the Samoan families are out at the farm, and they've got a taro patch because that's their food culture they're bringing to the farm. Or, you know, some of the families from El Salvador or Mexico are growing squash and tomatoes. And then last year, like, the Vietnamese family grew these, like, crazy peppers. So it does offer, like, this way for people to come in and participate in their own way, bringing their own culture.
That's totally true.
A large percentage of the folks who applied for being the goat herder San Francisco from Craigslist were people of color. The two goat herders that I did hire, both black, one is African-American, the other is a Jamaican-American. He would be here tonight, but he's out in the Presidio with the goats. So, you know, that's our experience.
Good evening. I have a quick question in terms of the allocation of plots. I was just granted a space in Dog Patch Garden in Bernal Heights, and luckily I only had to wait a few months, but I signed up for pretty much every community garden in the city, and I had a lot of feedback saying, oh yeah, this is great, but you might have to wait for 3 to 5 years, you know, for a spot. So with the urban farming, which I'm all new to the farming, I haven't even really heard of it in San Francisco, but how are you guys, when it does super take off like it is, and you guys do run out of space, how are you going to allocate? Like, are you guys going to do the whole waiting list thing like you do with the... Because it is a trend that is taking off, and it's a long list and a long line.
We're one as a collective, so we don't have individual plots. Like, we manage the space collectively, knowing that in doing that, you get some beneficial like micro economies of scale, and we can grow more food by working together than we would if we had 50 individual plots out there. We probably also have a greater diversity of stuff. But yes, it's a big problem here in San Francisco. There's, I think, 52 community gardens, and most of them have a waiting list. I'd say, again, another great opportunity to contact members of the Board of Supervisors or members of the Park Commission and say, we want more community gardens, because the land is out there. The land's not an issue. There's plenty of land in San Francisco. It's about taking available Department of Public Works properties or Port Authority properties or Recreation and Park Department properties and doubling the number of community gardens here in the city, because definitely the demand is there.
Yeah, I second that. We had, I think, around maybe 1,500, 2,000 people who wanted to have their backyards farmed when I was working with the organization My Farm. And we were able to install about 120 of those in a year. So let's say there's roughly 1,500 people who still want these farms in their backyard. And so I'm a huge proponent of connecting those people who want something happening in their backyard to the people who want to garden, because these community gardens are just too high a demand, too hard to get to, too infrequent. And when there is this kind of demand, we're going to see people who maybe don't mind a few random people or a few people with a little contract, whatever it takes, to actually come into the backyard and farm. And that's really easy to set up. In fact, there's a website now, y2g.com or Yards to Gardens or something, that's trying to facilitate that. And I know the part of the Urban Agriculture Alliance that we're forming is actually looking to bolster that, looking to connect those people who want and to garden with people who have space to garden.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, everyone, for being here. It's really great to get to hear all of your perspectives and hear all your voices at the same time. I heard today that 45% of the produce that's eaten in the city of San Francisco, that volume could be grown here in San Francisco. There's enough arable land for that. But I just kind of heard it randomly, so I thought this would be a good place to check if you heard substantiation of that thought.
I don't know the actual answer to that. I hope that it's true, because I just heard today as well that 50% of the food is wasted by the time it gets to you. So maybe with that 45%, with the 50 that's wasted, we can actually feed everyone, which would be a pretty awesome goal.
Unfortunately, they're percentages of different things, so that doesn't add up.
Sure.
I'm not sure. I don't know about that number, because, you know, Detroit, which is like totally, you know, ground zero for urban ag, everything urban ag, there's like people are, you know, selling their produce at the liquor store kind of thing. That's 5%. And so that number is pretty small. And I remember being kind of disappointed with that number. And then
that's 5% of the food that's being eaten is grown locally. But I didn't phrase my question very clearly. I understand there's enough arable land in San Francisco to grow to meet 45% of the fresh fruit and vegetable demand in San Francisco.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Detroit is using most of their arable land. Okay. It, you know, so I would be surprised if that number is correct. But I mean, you know, I could be wrong. What am I, a naysayer? But what I'm trying to say is that actually 5% is huge, and the city of Richmond in the East Bay, that's their goal, is 5%. Because, you know, we can't, you know, and this is the problem. Everyone's all like, oh, urban farming can't feed everyone. But, like, 5%, what if we could grow 5% of the food? I mean, then we get, you know, that's huge. And you know, if we are wasting 50% of it, then, you know, it's something to think about. Like, maybe we should stop wasting so much food, too. So thinking about all the other stuff, like, is what we're doing now working, you know? And if you start growing your own food, you're not going to waste it. And so then it just changes patterns.
Thank you.
Yeah. I just had two questions, essentially. Just what are your cost-effective strategies, i.e. like seed saving or composting, for low-income folks? And then also preferred techniques, like permaculture or biodynamic farming. Do you have any preferred techniques on what would be the most productive?
Well, I mean, I think you hit part of it, right? It's sweat equity. It's like you can keep your costs pretty low the more of your own physical labor you're willing to put in. And then maybe you get into a trade-off of, well, how much is your time worth? But I do think that if you know, in theory, you could just be paying for seeds and water. And yes, you would want to use, like, I think, most efficient water-saving techniques. So you don't have a huge water bill. But I do think some form of backyard micro-scale gardening is available and accessible to most to most households, for sure. Us at Alamany, we are actually a demonstration farm, so we're doing all sorts of stuff. Part of the farm is a kind of a John Jevons-style bio-intensive or French-intensive system. Other parts of the farm are a permaculture design, and some parts of the farm we've sort of taken aside as native plant restoration and native plant habitat for also for fauna. So we're just trying to mix up a lot of different things and show people, here are all the things you can do.
For me, I like French intensive is what I practice mostly, just because it's a real, it's so, in, like it says, it's intense. You're growing all different crops together. And my favorite thing to do is do just lettuce, seed lettuce really thickly, and then do cut and come again, because you just literally get your scissors out, and then you have these amazing salad greens that you don't have to wash that much, which is good for me. And then you know, it just comes back. So it just keeps on giving. So like really intensive planting, and really using every space that you possibly can. In terms of animals, bees are awesome. If you ever do like a cost analysis of that, once you get the equipment and you can catch swarms or split swarm hives and things like that, then they really do, you know, the honey is so valuable and so doesn't take up that much space. You can go on vacation. The bees don't mind, unlike goats. And so bees are, I'm totally a bee advocate.
Yeah. Hi. No, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you all so much for being here and for sharing this information and for the work that you do. My interest in urban farming is from a social justice perspective, both for feeding the hungry and also for feeding myself. I want to grow my own food. I'm just starting to learn about this. I'm just starting to get into it and growing a little bit of food in my apartment. And that's a challenge. There's no dirt. There's no earth. And so I really want to find out more about where can I get my hands dirty and grow food for myself. But I also, you're talking about 52 different gardens around the city. From a quick look at your website for Alamany Farm and then also for Hayes Valley Farm, it sounds like the missions and the visions are different. Some are designed for feeding the hungry, and others are for, I guess, like timeshare for people to grow their own food. So I'd like for you to talk a little bit about that. For your own farms, but also broadly sort of how you see things happening in the city in terms of what the vision is for people to grow their own food versus feeding folks that don't have food.
I can jump in there really quickly. I have been talking to people, for instance, that are, you know, it's almost like you have to draw from your own life. It's not like you're like sitting in the apartment and then someone's going to be like, hey, here's a garden. It's like you need to sort of like check out your resources. So, for instance, I was in D.C. and these parents had started a garden on the school property, right? They had this stupid lawn, huge lawn, and the parents were like, why not have a garden there? So, you know, if you have like other resources or a church, you know, Memorial Glide has a huge rooftop garden that you can work on. So, you know, you're kind of, it's like, it, that's what it does for you, is that you have to expand out to like the other things in your life to find out where you can do the garden. It's like this crazy thing. So I would just like kind of do an inventory of that, or like, do you have a friend that has a garden, a backyard that they're not using, or, you know, space like that. I mean, I know that in Oakland, at least, there's all these schools that are like going under, right? The schools don't exist anymore. And I'm like, what's going on with that land? You know, so you have to get like really creative, because no one's going to just give it to you. You got to fight for it.
I'd say you got to find the space and then go and buy Pam Pierce's excellent book, Golden Gate Gardening, and read it cover to cover. And that'll at least, if you've got a little amount of space and you've got Pam Pierce's Golden Gate Gardening and some sweat equity, you will be able to grow something in your backyard. And even if you have no sun, then think about mushrooms. I mean, there's always something you can do, right? There's always something you can do.
Next question.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for being here. Can you hear me? Okay. So I just started volunteering over at O-Bugs in Oakland and with Urban Sprouts. And so I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about the future of urban gardening and being learned in schools. And I think that if every school were to have a garden and kids could learn from a young age where their food is coming from, you know, there would be a huge difference. And so I don't know if you guys know more about what's up and coming, you know, about the farm to... cafeteria movement and everything like that. But if you guys could talk a little bit more about what you know.
A little bit. I know that here in San Francisco, the San Francisco Unified School District has been really excellent at trying to put in school gardens. I think that's part of the reason why most field trips out to Alamany Farm that come from the Unified School District, the kids are really sharp. Like, you know, again, they know more than the Silicon Valley executives about sort of the basics because they've gotten the exposure in their classrooms, at least in some small way. So I think what's happening here in San Francisco is really impressive. I mean, obviously, Alice's Waters Edible Schoolyard, which I think is at MLK Junior High in Berkeley, is a national model in some ways, but that's not perhaps sustainable because it's got a blue chip name behind it, able to raise money for it. So the Edible Schoolyard is amazing. It's like, it's like a kind of a museum piece almost, but in some ways it's not replicable because it relies so much on outside funding. But I think what's happening here in San Francisco schools is really awesome.
I've seen a couple different models, but a lot of them are for older people. Like I was just in, Wisconsin, Appleton, and there's like a university where they're growing food and then selling that food back to the cafeteria. You know, like the cafeteria has a mandate that they buy the seeds and then they have to buy the stuff back at fair market price. So there's all these different models. I mean, I think the younger the better. You know, like we need like really little kids, like we need like kindergartners to start that. And right now, it's kind of an elite thing where you like go to Waldorf school or whatever and that's part of the curriculum, but I think it's just starting to spread around, and a lot of it is going to be the parents demanding that they learn that they need to learn that stuff. So that's who's gonna guide it. And there's cool projects. There's one in East Oakland called Pueblo where it's high schoolers and they go ride bikes around and pick fruit. They glean fruit from neighborhood fruit trees and then give it back to the elderly homes and stuff. So there's so many cool different models that people can jump on.
I think a lot of the leadership for that particular movement is going to have to come from the parents themselves. And if you look at how many parents are involved in each school system and you just asked for a particular donation, for example, I think it's Alice Fong Yu in the city actually has a huge edible schoolyard now. It's amazing. Mostly parent donations. Now, they actually spent a load of money, but I think there's a lot that's possible. I live with two environmental educators, and from my perspective, they haven't had the easiest time with the United or the school district to actually get gardens into the school system. So I think it's parents advocating for the children, advocating on behalf of them to the principal, to the bodies that be, to actually get some of the food into the schoolyards, because there's loads of sun there. You walk into the schoolyards, there's tons of sun here. Tons of opportunity. I think a little campaign, they have Kickstarter campaigns online. You could probably raise some funds, put in a school garden. What does it take, $1,000? It doesn't take much. And then someone like yourself, maybe to volunteer part-time until they could actually afford paying you or making a staff position. I think there's this ample opportunity, and the younger the better.
But you have to get the teachers involved, too. That's huge. The teachers have to get on board, too, because they're the ones that are going to last there, right? And so that's another thing. And there's a great new book. I can't remember the title, but it's all about starting an edible schoolyard in your school. So it gives resources and curriculum for teachers, so it's awesome.
We have time for maybe one more.
Jason, I think you touched on this with the book you recommended, but in our very small backyard in the Mission, we're thinking about growing some things, and I need something easy. I was thinking maybe mint for my mojitos or something, or just basil or something simple. But I heard tomatoes have a lot of bugs and there's a lot of labor. So is there something just to get somebody started who's not going to spend too much sweat equity?
I mean, that's a great thing. If you have a little bit of flat ground, just sow out some salad mix, and again, cut and come again. You should get 4, 5, 6 cuttings off it if you keep it really well watered. I'd say in San Francisco, almost in any neighborhood, grow some kale, right? Or any sort of leafy greens. They're the easiest things. They really like our climate here. They do pretty well. So kale, collards, chard, cabbages do really well in the winter. I mean, I think there's low-hanging fruit. There's a number of easy... There's a number of easy things, but I would say kale, and if you don't like kale, develop a liking to kale. And it's one of the easiest things to grow, and supposedly, I don't know if this is apocryphal also, it's like one of the most nutrient-dense foods you can eat. So
Chard,
yeah. And you can just keep cutting that, and it'll last, 12 to 18 months before it starts going to seed, and kind of can plant it like every 14 to 16 months and just keep chugging away.
So there is a new tradition at Inforum to spend the final minute or so asking the panelists very briefly, what is your 60-second idea to change the world? So we're going to have to start with one of you and go down the row. David, you want to start?
Sure. I think that if we can get our leadership and our decision makers and political people to start thinking kind of outside the box and thinking in a holistic way, they can start actually looking at the big picture and thinking about the impact beyond just what we see and what's on our table and the like. And from our perspective, if they look at some of those externalities and look at the impacts of bringing stuff in from far away, it'll be abundantly clear that the closer we can get to farming in our communities, the better off we'll be.
So I have a question to ask the crowd. Raise your hand if you've eaten in the past day. Just raise it up. Okay, everyone. Raise your hand if you've eaten San Francisco-grown vegetables in the past day. That's actually pretty awesome. So call to action. There's about 20% of you that raised your hands in the last question. Join me and join Hayes Valley Farm and all these other wonderful people and do what I actually heard about today called the crop mob. And so actually get together, form these little groups of people, go in, transform a backyard in a day and a half a day, have a potluck around it, have fun. You get your land, you get access to food, you can all eat and raise your hand next time we're here. And, we'll have a robust backyard kitchen program in San Francisco, in the Bay Area at large, in the next 5 to 10 years if we keep doing that.
I always say this, but I think every city should have a demonstration urban farm, that you go to that city, and that's part of like a cool tourist thing, right? You know, you're like, show up and you're like, I wonder what they grow here. And then you have a person that, you know, manages it. It's a decent space, amount of space. And they show people like how to raise chickens and bees and can vegetables. And maybe there's an outdoor kitchen if you're in San Francisco. And, and so that would be this really great place. And then you always have that to go to. When I went to Milwaukee, I was basically did that when I went to Growing Power. I was like, I got to see Will Allen's setup. And there were so many people there on that tour. They have a tour every day. So there is that demand. And obviously there's so many people here and people are excited about it. So why not make that, you know, the Office of Urban Farming and you get some funding from the city to run it and show people how to grow their own food.
I guess I often say this as well, I already said it, which is, you know, find a little bit of land and a little bit of water and then find a friend or, a family member to work it with you and start as a pair and then find a third person to also help you. And then from there, find like-minded people, neighbors who are also doing this stuff because, right, there's only individual coping mechanisms. And all solutions are, by definition, collective, right? These things, we can all put our little seed in the ground, but I don't think personal actions alone are really going to get us to the transition we want. We need political actions, and political actions means getting together and building a movement. So after you and your couple of friends have got your little piece of land and your water, find some other folks who are doing similar work and talk to them and find out how to take it bigger, or talk to everybody else in this room and your neighbors over wine and treats in the lobby.
All right, good transition. So let's give a hand to Jason Mark, Novella Carpenter, Chris Burley, David Gavrich. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.